I think I have it. Thank you for your presence. I appreciate your interest. Please, so much your participation by turning to the passages that we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be looking at several. Would invite you to open your Bibles to Habakkuk chapter 1, where we're going to introduce our study tonight as we talk about faith in times of a faithless nation. I have on the board a chart that I just looked at a moment ago and raised a question. Faith and a faithless nation. I'm talking about the subject of faith throughout this week. And of course, from Hebrews chapter 11, we see faith defined. We see numerous illustrations of faith given. And we noted that we can believe what God said, and we can act upon what God said. The title on the screen before us is not to suggest that we need to express faith in a faithless nation. That's not the object of our study. But the object of our study is to discuss faith in God. When we may live in a faithless nation, and we may live in a world that seems to not express faith in God, doesn't believe what He says, doesn't act upon what He says. And I want to suggest to you, beloved, that in our study tonight, as we use Habakkuk chapter 1 and chapter 2 and on into some thoughts of chapter 3 as a basis of our study, Habakkuk lived among people that were in disobedience to God. Very simply put, he expresses faith in God in a time when the nation in which he lived did not. And that was a perplexing circumstance to this Old Testament prophet. And thus his question in verse 2 of chapter 1, O Jehovah, how long shall I cry, and wilt thou not hear? I cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Habakkuk is concerned, how long, God, must this circumstance continue? And God assures him that he has a plan. And in the plan of God, he says in verse 5, Behold ye among the nations, and look and wonder marvelously, for I am working a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you. Now Habakkuk, you believe that I have a plan. Evil will not be tolerated. It will not continue. When circumstances exist in the nation of the people of God, there is a termination point at which God is through, and that which he has threatened, he will bring to pass. And Habakkuk needs to believe God. And he said, because of the plan that I have, if I tell you about it, you won't believe it. You see, the point is, I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans, and the Chaldeans are going to take the people of Judah captive. And Habakkuk said, in essence, how can you use them when they're more wicked than we are? I don't understand. And God says, I have a plan for the Chaldeans too, and you need to just wait. It will play out. And as we look at the second chapter of the book of Habakkuk, in verse 4, he said, Behold, his soul is pulled up. It is not upright in him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Now Habakkuk, just hold on and believe what I tell you. And you act accordingly. And you do what I tell you to do. Now beloved, that's the substance of the things that we're going to talk about tonight. But what I want us to see is that we do live in a time when we question the things that go on round about us. And sometimes we look at those things and we're very displeased and unhappy about that. And we wonder about the future. What does it hold? And what is it going to be? Habakkuk's faith grew stronger in the face of circumstances such as that, though he did not understand why God allowed sin to run rampant in Judah without punishment. But Habakkuk had to learn to wait for the hand of God to fulfill his own purposes in his own time and in his own way. He had to believe that God would take care of this. And beloved, we too must live by faith in him, even in times when we look at a nation that seems to rebel against God and has no regard nor respect for God. But Habakkuk finally had to learn in chapter 2 and verse 20 that the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. God has a plan, and beloved, He rules, and He's not out of control, and nothing escapes His sight. And we need to see that. And that was the lesson that Habakkuk had to learn. Now what I want us to do is to see that in our study tonight. God rules the universe from the beginning to the end. Let's go back to this chart. We know in Proverbs chapter 14 and in verse 34, the wisdom writer said, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. In Proverbs 16, the writer said, it is an abomination to kings to commit wickedness, for the house is established by righteousness. You recall in the New Testament when the Apostle Paul came into the city of Athens, and we read concerning the Epicurean philosophers and Stoic philosophers, how that they came together to tell or to hear some new thing, and they thought that the things that the Apostle Paul presented were worthy to listen to because they simply had not heard those things before. Paul said something about salvation through a resurrected Christ, and they had never heard anything like that before. And if Paul came into their city and saw the various objects of their worship, there was one with an altar with the inscription to the unknown God. And Paul said, what therefore, ye worship in ignorance, this I set forth unto you, the God that made the world and all things therein, he being Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Now verse 25, neither is he served by men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he himself giveth to all life and breath and all things. And he made of one every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek God, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And the writer goes on to tell us how that Paul declared to the Athenians that there is a set time in which God is going to judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, and that he hath raised him from the dead. Some of these people were interested in hearing more of what Paul had to say. Others simply mocked what he had already said. But what we learn in this is that Paul is preaching in a city where people had no regard for God, had no regard for what God said, because they did not know God. They did as they pleased. And of course, the history of the study of idolatry tells us that. But as we look at this particular circumstance, we learn who God is. God is Lord of heaven and earth. He's not out of control, beloved. He knows what occurs. And God has a plan, if you please, which has been exercised in times gone by. When you turn your Bible to Genesis chapter 6 through chapter 9, you note in these texts that there was a time when even the imagination of man's heart was on the evil continually. And the text tells us that it repented God that he had made man, and he determined to destroy man from off the face of the earth. The wickedness of man, chapter 6, verse 5, was great in the earth. Not long thereafter, in Genesis chapter 11, we note that man in his arrogance united in rebellion against God and tried to build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And you'll note that God chastened mankind so as to restrain their sin and their ignorance by diversifying their languages and scattering them upon the face of the earth. God can do that, you see, because he's not out of control. When man becomes so arrogant that he thinks he knows more than what God could ever know, God has a way of dealing with that. And so we see that in Genesis chapter 11. But as you turn further in your Old Testament text, hold that thought and turn, if you will, to the Old Testament text of Genesis chapter 18 through chapter 19. In Genesis chapter 18 through chapter 19, we read of Lot in the city of Sodom. And it tells us in chapter 18, in verse 20, and Jehovah said, because the city of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know. And the men turned from thence and went unto Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before Jehovah. And Abraham drew near and said, Wilt thou consume the righteous with the wicked? And he makes a proposal. Will you destroy all of them if there are yet 50 that are righteous? And God said, No, if there are 50 that can be found that are righteous, I will spare the city. Well, what about if they're lacking only 5, if there are 45 that are righteous? Will you destroy them all when there are 45 that are righteous? And God said, No, if there are 45 that are righteous, I will spare them. And you read in the text that it drops from 30 to 20 and then down to 10. The cities would be spared if there were only 10 righteous, but not so. What we see in this is that God held the determining factor. He could spare them or he could destroy them, depending upon the number of righteous souls that were found that were in those cities. God held that right. He had that authority to do that. And if we read on in the 19th chapter, the text tells us, beginning in verse 23, the sun was risen upon the earth when Lot came unto Zoar, and Jehovah rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from Jehovah out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. What do we learn in this? Well, there were not 10 found. And God's judgment was pronounced upon these cities, and they were destroyed. Who did that? God did. He did that. Now, why did he do that? Was it because he hated the people that were there? No, that was not the issue, was it? But he despised the sin that they were committing. You see, God's chastening and judgment reflect his patience and his love as he seeks to save man. The prophet Ezekiel reveals in chapter 33 and in verse 11, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. That's God's desire. Even when God spoke to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12, 13, 14, and 15, you recall in that text that there was a time element involved in the time when the land of promise would be given to the descendants of Abraham. That time element was 430 years down the pike, 4 generations down the pike. Why? God said, because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. God was giving them opportunity to either get better or get worse. Their choice. But judgment would come if they got worse. Do we see that? Do we see that? See, God had the right to do that. As we consider the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, we've already talked about that, we'll pass from that chart, we see very simply that God had the right to destroy those who continued the practice of wicked things. Now, I want to call your attention to God's people, the people of Israel. Turn back, if you will, to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 4. Deuteronomy, chapter 4. We're going to be reading a lot of passages this evening. I would encourage you to take out your Bibles and please do follow along. I'm reading from the 1901 American Standard Translation. I want you to know that. But as we read from the text, please follow along. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, in verse 25 beginning, after Moses has led them out of Egyptian bondage, we read beginning in verse 25, it says, When thou shalt beget children and children's children, ye shall have been long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves, and make a graven image in the form of anything, and shall do that which is evil in the sight of Jehovah thy God, to provoke him to anger. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereunto ye go over the Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. And Jehovah will scatter you among the peoples, and ye shall be left few in number among the nations, whether Jehovah shall lead you away. God told these people long before they ever entered into the promised land, here's what will happen when you worship idols. God will destroy you out of this good land. Do you see that? That's not just an idle threat, beloved. Moses said, when you do this, this is what God will do. Now, do you believe that or not? Look further in the text. Turn the page, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 8. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, reading beginning in verse 19. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 19. Moses again said, And it shall be, if thou shalt forget Jehovah thy God, and walk after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish. As the nations that Jehovah maketh to perish before you, so shall ye perish because you would not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah your God. That's twice counted. That Moses has told them, when you worship idols, here's what God will do. Do you see that? Look further, if you will, in Deuteronomy chapter 30. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, I would call your attention to verses 1 through 10. We'll not read the entirety of it, but it's in the context of the blessing and curses, or blessings and curses that Moses pronounces upon these people. But in the 30th chapter, beginning in verse 1, he said, and it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, whether Jehovah thy God hath driven thee. Look at the time frame here, beloved. Moses is telling them these things before they enter into the promised land. And he uses the term when. Do you see that? When you do this. It's not a matter now of this. It's when you do it. Look further at the text. When you do this, and you call to mind among the nations where Jehovah has driven you, what's he telling them? You're going to choose to serve idols. And you will be driven out of this land. And you will be driven unto other nations. And you will be taken captive by them. And then in verse 2, and shall return unto Jehovah thy God, and shall obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the peoples whether Jehovah thy God has scattered thee. What's Moses telling them before they inherit the promised land? When you do this, this is what God's going to do to you. You will be driven out. You will become captives of another nation. And when you turn there, remembering what God has done for you, when you turn, then God will turn thy captivity. What do you expect to read further in the history of Israel? You expect to read about their captivity, don't you? You expect to read about their decisions to become faithless and the God who delivered them out of Egyptian bondage. And as you continue reading in this very text, in verse 10, you'll note the condition upon these people. He said, if thou shalt obey the voice of Jehovah thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, if thou turn unto Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. Moses makes it more than just simply clear, abundantly clear, that when you keep the law, God will bring you back into this land, and you will be turned from your captivity. Do we see that, brethren? Now the question is whether or not they believed it. Well, we know they didn't, because that's the course that they charted. And God sent chastisements and judgments upon them time and time and time and time again. We know that Joshua brought them into the promised land. We know that Moses saw the promised land from Deuteronomy chapter 34, the very land that was promised unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he was not allowed to go in. And as you turn to Joshua chapter 1, Joshua was to be the leader to lead them into the land. Look at verse 6. Joshua chapter 1, verse 6. Be strong and of good courage. For thou shalt cause this people to inherit the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous to observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Joshua would lead them in. When you continue to read through the text of the book of Joshua, and you come to the 11th chapter of the book of Joshua, and you read in chapter 11, beginning at verse 23, it says, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that Jehovah spake unto Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land had rest for more. Question, did they get the land that God promised them? Absolutely. Was it the land that was promised unto Abraham in Genesis chapter 15 from the river Euphrates down to the river of Egypt? Yes, the very land. The very land that was promised unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Joshua led them into. How do we know? Look at Joshua chapter 21, verse 43. In Joshua chapter 21, verse 43, the text tells us, so Jehovah gave unto Israel all the land. Now, beloved, what land? The land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. And Jehovah gave them rest round about according to all that he sware unto their fathers, and there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. Jehovah delivered all their enemies into their hand. There failed not aught of any good thing which Jehovah had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. Sounds like Joshua was the man that did it, doesn't it? But you know, it's almost like someone, or like Joshua, expected someone to argue the case, isn't it? As you turn to chapter 23, he said it again. And I want to call your attention to that. Joshua chapter 23, beginning in verse 14. There the writer says, and behold this day, I am going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing hath failed of all the good things which Jehovah your God spake concerning you. All are come to pass unto you. Not one thing hath failed thereof. Now look at verse 15. And it shall come to pass that as all the good things are come upon you, of which Jehovah your God spake unto you, so will Jehovah bring upon you all the evil things, until he have destroyed you from off this good land, which Jehovah your God hath given you. When ye transgress the covenant of Jehovah your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods, and bow down yourselves to them, then will the anger of Jehovah be kindled against you, and ye shall perish quickly from off the good land, which he hath given unto you. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Well, that's what Moses told them when he brought them up out of the land of Egypt. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, in Deuteronomy chapter 8, in Deuteronomy chapter 10, they've heard this very same sermon before, haven't they? This is not new. And so here again is the threat of God. Chastisement after chastisement. Prophet after prophet. Sent to them to call upon them to turn from their wickedness, to stop the worship of idols, and they would not listen. And as we come to the days of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 9, Isaiah chapter 9, read with me beginning in verse 8. In Isaiah chapter 9, in verse 8, the writer says, the Lord sent a word unto Jacob, and it hath lighted upon Israel. And all the people shall know that Ephraim in the inhabitant of Samaria that say in pride, in stoutness of heart, the bricks are fallen, but we will build them or build with hewn stone. The sycamores are cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. Therefore Jehovah will raise up on high against him the adversaries of reason, and will stir up his enemies, the Syrians before and the Philistines behind, and they shall devour Israel with open mouth. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. Look carefully in these verses, because there are a number of thoughts that we want to emphasize. Number one, the stubbornness on behalf of Israel. Moses told them, if you come into the land and worship idols, you'll be destroyed. Joshua brought them in and said, when you worship idols, you'll be destroyed. And now we have a number of generations that have passed, and what are they doing? They're worshiping idols, and the prophet Isaiah tells them, you're going to be destroyed. And their attitude is, the bricks are fallen, but we'll build with stone. You might destroy our cities, but we'll put them back. He says, the sycamores are cut down, but we'll put cedars in their place. You can't do anything to us, but what we can't build back with greater. Oh, what arrogance. Now let me ask you, beloved, do you think God's going to tolerate that? Turn, if you will, in your Old Testament text to the book of Amos. Amos. In Amos chapter 4, begin reading at verse 6. This Old Testament prophet said, and I also have given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and want of bread in all your places, yet ye have not returned unto me, saith Jehovah. I also have withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and caused it to rain upon one city, and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. So two or three cities wandered into one city to drink water, and were not satisfied. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Jehovah. I have smitten you with blasting and mildew, the multitude of your gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees hath the palmer worm devoured. Yet ye have not returned unto me, saith Jehovah. I have sent among you the pestilence after the manner of Egypt. Your young men have I slain with the sword, and have carried away your horses, and have made the stench of your camp to come up even unto your nostrils. Yet ye have not returned unto me, saith the Lord. I have overthrown cities among you, as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and ye were as a brand plucked out of the burning, yet ye have not returned unto me, saith Jehovah. Now look at verse 12. Therefore, thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. For lo, he that formeth the mountains, and createth the wind, and declareth unto man what is his thought, that maketh the morning darkness, and treadeth upon the high places of the earth, Jehovah the God of hosts is his name. You get ready, judgment is coming. You remember that which Moses threatened way back there in Deuteronomy chapter 4? You remember all the pestilences and afflictions that had come upon you? This was to exercise the patience of God and give you opportunity to return, and you didn't return. And now you get ready, because judgment is coming. Prepare to meet thy God. And how's all that going to play out? Look at your Bible. Turn back, if you will, to the text of Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 10, Isaiah chapter 10, in Isaiah chapter 10, reading beginning at verse 5, there the text says, Ho, Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation. I will send him against the profane nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth he does his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he saith, Are not my princes, all of them kings? Is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? As my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, do so to Jerusalem and to her idols? Who is going to be the instrument of God's wrath, even upon his own people? God says, I'm going to use Assyria. Now, Assyria doesn't intend to be the instrument of my wrath, but they will be. I will use that wicked nation, and they will conquer my people, and they will be the administrators of my wrath upon my people. You know why God could say that? Because God had a plan. And God was in control. And he knew what he was going to do long before the people of God chose to disobey him. You see, God had already planned punishment for his people and had already told them that they would be taken into captivity. Do you see that? This was not a surprise to God. And when you turn in your Old Testament, during the period of the kings, read with me beginning in 2 Kings chapter 17. And we read of the fall of the city of Samaria. 2 Kings chapter 17. We might note just here in passing that not one good king among all of the northern kings, not one. Every one of them served idols. And we see prophet after prophet, incident after incident of God's appeal to them to return and their continued rebellion. But as you read chapter 17, beginning in verse 1, it says, In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, began Hoshea, the son of Elah, to reign in Samaria over Israel and reign 9 years. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, yet not as the kings of Israel that were before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser, king of Assyria. And Hoshea became his servant and brought him tribute. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land and went up to Samaria to besiege it 3 years.
In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away unto Assyria and placed them in Hala and on Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. What are we reading, beloved? You see, the king of the northern ten tribes had brought tribute unto the king of Assyria, and now he has chosen to make an alliance with the king of Egypt, thinking that he can ward off any offense from Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria said, no, that's not going to work. And so he rains down upon these people and takes them captive. Well, wasn't that what God had said a long time ago? Well, why did that happen? Look, if you will, at verse 14 of chapter 17. In verse 14 it says, notwithstanding they would not hear, but hardened their neck like the neck of their fathers, who believed not in Jehovah their God. What's the problem here? Why are they worshiping idols? Why has all this come upon them? It's because they do not trust God. They don't believe in God anymore. They're worshiping idols. They don't believe what God says. And then in verse 15 it says, and they rejected his statutes, and his covenant that he had made with their fathers, and his testimony which he testified unto them. And they followed vanity and became vain, and went after the nations that were round about them, concerning whom Jehovah had charged them that they should not do like them. Well, they're doing the very things they said they wouldn't do. Remember from a previous study, from Joshua chapter 24, when he called upon them, choose you this day whom you will serve. And they said, oh, we'll serve God. He it is that brought us up out of the land of Egypt. He it is that provided for us during the time of the wilderness. And he it is that brought us across this Jordan. He it is that has blessed us in all these great ways. And Joshua said, you're witnesses to yourselves. And they said, yes, we are. We'll follow God. No, you won't. No, you won't. You'll worship idols because you want to be like everybody else. In Judges chapter 2, beginning in verse 10, after the death of Joshua and those of his generation, what are they doing? They're worshiping idols, just like everybody else. And Moses said, when you do that, here's what's going to happen. Now, do we believe what God has to say? Did they? No, they continued to pursue that course, and here we see the consequences. Now, in 2 Kings chapter 17, we note through chapter 19 it is, we read of the threat of the king of Assyria as he marches into Judah and threatens Hezekiah, the king of Judah. I want you to look with me in 2 Kings chapter 17, 18, and on into chapter 19. 2 Kings chapter 17, 18, and 19. In the 17th chapter, we read at the beginning of the Samaritan people. This is just a preview. It doesn't cost any more. It's just interesting to note the history of the Samaritan people. You remember in John chapter 4 when Jesus was speaking with the Samaritan woman about worship, and Jesus said to that Samaritan woman, ye worship that which ye know not, we worship that which we know. That was a perplexing thought to me for a long time until I began to think about the history of the Samaritans. Ye worship that which ye know not, Jesus said to this Samaritan woman. Well, go back to their history in 2 Kings chapter 17. The king of Assyria, when he conquered the northern ten tribes, he mixed those people with other heathen nations that he had conquered, and now we've got a mix of people living in the land of Canaan. And this mix of people are being eaten by the lions. And their explanation of that is, to the king of Assyria, we know not the God of Israel. All right, well, we can fix that. We'll bring back one of the priests of Israel, and he'll teach you about the God of the land of Israel. Now, that just sounds like that makes all kinds of sense, doesn't it? Except, what does that priest know about God? Why were they taken captive? Because they were worshiping idols. What does this priest know about God? He's just one of many. And that's what he teaches these people. Look back at the text of 2 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 27. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry thither one of the priests whom he brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let them teach them the law of the God of the land. So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear Jehovah. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But now look at the results, verse 32. So they feared Jehovah and made unto them from among themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the houses of the high place or places. They feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they have been carried away. Unto this day they do after their former manner. They fear not Jehovah, neither do they after their statutes or after their ordinances or after the law or after the commandment which Jehovah commanded the children of Israel, whom he named Israel, with whom Jehovah had charged made a covenant, and charged them, saying, ye shall not fear other gods, nor bow down yourselves unto them. Dropping down to verse 41, so these nations feared Jehovah and served their graven images. Now that priest really taught them well, didn't he? They don't know a thing about God. So when Jesus said to that Samaritan woman, ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews. Well, the Samaritans never really had an accurate understanding of who God is, did they? From their very beginning, they didn't understand who God is, or they wouldn't have worshipped him right along with the other gods. He's just another god to them. Now, that's fascinating to me. And we find that right in the setting here of the conquering of the northern 10 tribes. Now, when the king of the Assyrian Empire seemed to be so successful in conquering the city of Samaria, he thinks he can march right on through Jerusalem and destroy the southern kingdom as well, but you see, there's a problem. God said, if you keep my commandments, you keep my statutes and my ordinances, I will bless you. If you turn from me and don't do that, I'll curse you. What is it that the northern 10 tribes have done? They worship idols. And now they're taken captive. Hezekiah is the king of the southern kingdom of Judah, and he's faithful to God. And look at the text, if you will. Reading beginning in verse 13. Verse 13 of chapter 18. It says, now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish, saying, I have offended, return from thee. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And the next few verses tell us that Hezekiah tried to save Judah by paying these taxes or tribute. But then in verse 19 it tells us, and Rabshakeh, who was the field commander, the captain of King Sennacherib's army, said unto them, say ye now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Look carefully at your text. What is it that he observes about King Hezekiah? King Hezekiah has faith in God during these turbulent times. He trusts in God. Do you see that? Now, Rabshakeh wants to know, why do you do that? Why do you trust in God? Thou sayest, but they are but vain words. There is counsel and strength for the war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou hast rebelled against me? Now behold, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt. No, that won't work. Whereon, if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it, so is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and all that trust upon him. But if ye say unto me, we trust in Jehovah our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away, and hath said unto Judah and to Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? You see, the understanding of Rabshakeh is that Jehovah God is just another among many idols, and he says, why do you trust him? He can't help you. And then in verse 23, Now therefore I pray thee, give pledges unto my master the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses, if thou be able on thy part to set riders upon them. How then canst thou turn away in face of one captain of the least of my master's servants, and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Am I now come up without Jehovah against this place to destroy it? Jehovah said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. No. God did not tell Sennacherib to do that. You see, because these people are trusting God. These people are trusting God. And as you look further at this text, we learn that there is a threat to these people. In verse 28, then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and spake, saying, hear ye the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he is not able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in Jehovah. Don't have faith in God. He can't do anything to deliver you. Don't let Hezekiah persuade you to such foolish hands. And then he says, this city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Don't believe that. He said, hearken not to Hezekiah. For thus saith the king of Assyria, make your peace with me, and come out to me, and eat ye every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his own cistern. Sound wonderful, doesn't it? Don't believe Hezekiah. He can't help you. God can't help you. But you see, King Sennacherib can. And the people do not believe Rabshakeh. They do not believe the promises of Sennacherib. They believe God. And they trust God. Now let me ask you, beloved, what happened to Sennacherib? Well, the rest of the story, as we say, is quite impressive. As you turn in the 19th chapter and begin reading in verse 32, it says, therefore, thus saith Jehovah concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into the city, nor shoot an arrow there, neither shall he come before it with shield, nor cast up a mound against it. By the same that he came, or by the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and he shall not come into the city, saith Jehovah. For I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. And it came to pass that night that the angel of Jehovah went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. Read it, beloved. That's 185,000 soldiers of Sennacherib's army that woke up dead that morning. They didn't march against Judah. They didn't march against Jerusalem. But rather, the king wound up his little ball of yarn and marched back to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, where his two sons killed him. And that was the end of Sennacherib. Now, my friend, when you read that, are you impressed with Hezekiah's faith in God during troublesome times? Faith in God among a faithless people, that is, the people of the Assyrians, didn't believe in God. But Hezekiah led his people to believe in God, to trust God. God responded by delivering them and defeating the Assyrians. I want to suggest to you, beloved, that Hezekiah believed God. And it becomes a demonstration of faith as he trusted God. Yes, the odds did not look in Hezekiah's favor. It looked quite threatening to Hezekiah. But Hezekiah knew that the power of God could deliver him. Now, just a little observation that someone made to me when I was talking about this one time. It says, you know, in verse 35, the angel of Jehovah went forth. The angel, one, went forth, and 185,000 Assyrian soldiers died. You remember when Jesus stood before Pilate? And Pilate threatened Jesus and said, don't you know that I have the power to kill you and I have the power to let you go? And Jesus reminded Pilate that you wouldn't have any power at all except it be given you of my Father. And don't you know that I have the authority to call down 12 legions of angels. Now you do the math. How many is a legion? Can you imagine the army that was at the disposal of the Lord to deliver him from the hand of Pilate? One angel. 185,000 soldiers dead. And Jesus allowed himself to be crucified. Just an interesting observation, isn't it? For those who trust in the Lord. But as we turn back to Hosea, we note that the Old Testament prophet has said in Hosea chapter 1 in verse 7, "But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by Jehovah their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, nor by horses, nor by horsemen." How were they saved? An angel of the Lord killed 185,000 of their enemies. Not a shot was fired. And God delivered his people. Now, why did he do that? Because, you see, they believed God. They had faith in God. They trusted God. And their leader, Hezekiah, had expressed that faith. Now, I want you to look at this map for just a moment. This map displays the division among the people of God, the northern 10 tribes of Israel, and the southern kingdom of Judah, made up of Benjamin and Judah. We're well aware of that, and we notice to the north here the Assyrian Empire during this period of the days of King Jeroboam of Israel and Uzziah of Judah. But look at this map. Here we see the expanse of the Assyrian Empire all the way down into Egypt. And so the threat was real that the Egyptians can't help you. You see, the Assyrians were to destroy Egypt as well. But during the days of King Hezekiah, king of Judah, you see this little blip on this map? Those of you in the back may not be able to see that. Just a little blip right there. That's Judah during the days of King Hezekiah. And we look at this massive empire of the Assyrians and how they had destroyed everything in their path except Judah during the days of King Hezekiah because he believed God. Now let me ask you, beloved, when we trust God during troublesome times, that's where we need to be, isn't it? When we look at Habakkuk the prophet and we look around us and we see troublesome times, and we don't understand why or how that exists. And we don't understand what God will do about that. We don't know. And perhaps that bothers us some. It need not bother us, beloved, because God hasn't lost a thing. He's not out of control. He still has plans. Now, beloved, here's what God planned during the days of King Hezekiah. You do what I tell you. And there's always a remnant that will be spared. And so it was during the days of the kings. The king Hezekiah. Now I want to look at another chapter in the history of God's people. God had a plan for the Assyrians too. Turn back, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 10. Isaiah chapter 10. And pick up at the next verse, verse 12. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 12. There it says, "Wherefore, it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he has said, by the strength of my hand, I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, and I have removed the bounds of the peoples, and have robbed their treasures, and like a valiant man, I have brought down them that sit on thrones, and my hand hath found as the nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are forsaken, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing, and or that opened the mouth, or chirped." Look at what I have done. You see, Mr. King of Assyria, you think that you've accomplished this all on your own. Not so. You see, Mr. King of Assyria, though it was not your intent, you were an instrument in my hand to administer my wrath. And now, because of your stout heart, I have a plan for you. Would it surprise you to note that in 612 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar united the Babylonian army with the army of the Medes and the Scythians, consistent with the prophecy of the Old Testament text of Zephaniah and the entire book of Nahum, as the city of Nineveh, the capital of the northern 10 tribes, was prophesied to be destroyed. God said, "I'm going to take care of you."
And so it came to pass. Turn, if you will, to Zephaniah chapter 2. Zephaniah chapter 2. This Old Testament book, beginning at verse 13. Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 13. It says, "He will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and will make Nineveh a desolation and dry like the wilderness, and herds shall lie down in the midst of her. All the beasts of the nations, both the pelican and the porcupine, shall lodge in the capitals thereof. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he hath laid bare their cedar work. This is the joyous city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am, and there is none besides me. How is she become desolation, a place for beasts to lie down in? Every one that passeth by her shall hiss and wag his hand." You see, Mr. High and Mighty and arrogant Assyrians, you're going to be destroyed. Who's going to do that? Well, the Babylonians are going to take care of you. And the complete desolation and destruction of Assyria is cited by the prophet Ezekiel in Ezekiel chapter 31 as a warning to the Egyptians that the same thing can happen to you. Well, as we continue turning in our pages, what about Judah? We look at Judah during the days of Hezekiah, and we say Judah was strong under the leadership of Hezekiah. They believed God, and they were spared from the destruction of the Assyrians. But they were not always faithful. They too were eventually characterized by unbelief, and the threat of God became a reality upon those of Judah. Turn your Bible to the Old Testament text of Jeremiah. Jeremiah begs and pleads with these people to return to the old paths. You'll read in Jeremiah chapter 6, and they said, "We will not walk therein." Won't do it. We don't believe God. We don't have any faith in God. And that's demonstrated in the 5th and 6th chapters. Well, in fact, throughout the book of Jeremiah. But if you'll notice in Jeremiah chapter 25, Jeremiah chapter 25, read with me beginning in verse 8. Jeremiah 25, verse 8. It says, "Therefore thus saith Jehovah of hosts, because ye have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Jehovah, and I will send unto Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof and against all these nations round about. And I will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and a hissing and a perpetual desolation. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of myrrh, and the voice of gladness, and the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride, and the sound of the millstones, and the light of the lamp. And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Captivity, you see. Why? Well, I told you way back there during the days of Moses, remember in Deuteronomy chapter 4, beginning in verse 25, that if you worship and serve idols, I will destroy you from this good land. It's happened with the northern 10 tribes, and now it's on your horizon. Judah likewise will be destroyed and taken by the Babylonians, and they will be captives for 70 long years. You can read about that in Jeremiah chapter 36 through chapter 39, where we read of the besiegement of the city of Jerusalem and the carrying away of these captives into Babylon. We note that Zedekiah becomes somewhat of a puppet king appointed by the king of Babylon. And in Jeremiah chapter 39, reading beginning in verse 6, it says, "Then the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah and Riblah before his eyes. Also the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. And the Chaldeans burned the king's house and the houses of the people with fire and break down the walls of Jerusalem. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive into Babylon the residue of the people that remained in the city, the deserters also that fell away to him, and the residue of the people that remained. And Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the poor of the people that had nothing in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields at the same time." The people are gone. They're taken captive. Why? Because they didn't believe God. They didn't trust in him. And consequently, Judah fell. Now, beloved, as we think about how awful that must have been for these people to be taken into captivity by the kingdom of Babylon, I want you to look again at the map.
You'll note that Assyria is gone, just like God said. The Babylonians have taken them. You don't see Israel on here because the Assyrians have already taken them. You don't see that little blob over here anymore because now Judah has been taken captive by the king of Babylon. And 70 long years pass. If you remember, as Habakkuk was told during this period of time, I have a plan for the Babylonians too. And so indeed, God did. Babylon is to be destroyed, and it was not to be inhabited. Let's go back to the prophecy of Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1. It tells us the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amos, did see. And he elaborates on what that was. In verse 17, beginning, he says, Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. Who shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it, and their bows shall dash the young men in pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes shall not spare children, and Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation, neither shall the Arabian pitch his tent there, neither shall shepherds make their flocks to lie down there, but wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and ostriches shall dwell there, and wild goats shall dance there, and wolves shall cry in their castles, and jackals in their pleasant palaces, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. What a vivid description of such a magnificent city that was known as the kingdom or the glory of the kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride. Well, look at the arrogance that characterized her kings during the days of Daniel. As he was one of these young captives, you'll read in Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4, beginning in verse 30. Daniel chapter 4, verse 30. There the writer tells us, verse 30 it is, it says, The king spake and said, Is not this great Babylon, which I have built for the royal dwelling place by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty? Does that sound the least bit familiar? Well, that's precisely what the king of Assyria said, wasn't it? In all of his might and power and glory, look at what I have done. And God said to Mr. King of Babylon, Not so. You're going to fall. You're going to be taken down. You will be destroyed. I understand that the city of ancient Babylon had two walls about 11 miles long. The outer wall was about 25 feet thick, and the inner one was about 23 feet thick. Had a population of about 500,000 people. That's a pretty good sized city, especially when you compare that to Horse Cave or Bear Wallow, Kentucky, that is. This was a big place. But God was going to destroy it. God was going to destroy it. And when you turn to Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51, you read of the destruction of this great and powerful empire. Jeremiah chapter 50 through 51. Now, we'll not read all of that, of course, but just simply looking at the text of Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51, you'll see the extent of that destruction. And you'll notice in these chapters, for example, in verse 9, it says, For lo, I will stir up the cause to come against Babylon, a company of great nations from the north country, and they shall set themselves in array against her. From thence she shall be taken, their arrows shall be as an expert mighty man. None shall return in vain. They're going to be expert marksmen. It's going to be total destruction. In verse 11, make sharp the arrows, hold firm the shields. Jehovah has stirred up the spirit of the kings of the Medes. This is chapter 51, verse 11. Because his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it, for it is the vengeance of Jehovah, the vengeance of his temple. Who's leading this army? Well, we say God is. That's right. God was using the Medes and the Persians to destroy the Babylonians. This great city has become heaps a dwelling place for jackals. Now, I would challenge some of you who are more computer literate than I am to do some research on the ancient city of Babylon
and see what's there today. I wouldn't ask that if I hadn't looked. There's a mound. And when you think of a city that had these great walls, when you think of a city that's known as the glory of this empire, all the riches and the splendor that any man or wealth could provide, and now all that's there is just a heap of dirt. Just a heap of dirt. Just a mound where the wild animals live. Let me ask you, beloved, what's that tell us about faith in God in a faithless nation? Do you believe what God says? We see God on every page of history, don't we? As He dealt with these nations that had contact with His people. And here's the next map. As you don't find the Babylonians on it, you see the Medes and the Persians and this great empire extending on down into Egypt. But the Babylonians are gone, their ancient history. The Assyrians are gone, their ancient history. And God said, when you repent, I'll bring you back into this land. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Time's quickly expired. But I want you to notice why God did that. During the days of Daniel, we note that all the world should see the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever He will and setteth up over it the basis of men. Didn't He do that with the Assyrians? Did He do that with the Babylonians? But He used them to accomplish His end, that all the world should see that the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. You see, Habakkuk is looking through a small hole, like you looking through the tube of cardboard with a paper towel all wrapped around. And all you see is what's through that little window. But God saw the whole thing, and He had a plan. Habakkuk couldn't see all of that. And all Habakkuk could do is stand back and believe what God said. Just believe what God said. Because God had a plan. And beloved, I want to look real quick at just two or three points, and then the lesson will be yours. Number one, the king of Assyria was in the hand of God. God said, He's the rod of mine anger. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. See how wicked the intent of the king of Assyria was? But God used him. And when he was through with him, God destroyed him. The king of Babylon was in the hand of God, and God said, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. And he used the king of Babylon to accomplish that. The Medes and the Persians were in the hand of God. As God saw the sins of Babylon and announced the woes upon them, and Habakkuk stood in awe. And the prophet learned that he had to wait, that God would ultimately fulfill His purpose. Now, beloved, I want to think just one more thought with you. When we read in the New Testament, in Romans chapter 1, in verses 16 and 17, do you see why the plan of God to save man through the preaching of the gospel seemed such a marvel at that time? Romans chapter 1, in verse 16 and 17. The writer said, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God and the salvation to everyone that believeth. To the Jew first and also to the Greek, for therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith. Where's that quote come from? Look back over there in Habakkuk where we were reading. The righteous shall live. When do they live, beloved? When they believe what God says. And they trust in Him enough to commit themselves into His hand. That's when the righteous live by faith. Now that was a perplexing problem to the Jew who heard the gospel. He thought he was something special because, you see, he was a Jew. Paul said the Gentile considers that message foolishness in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. They don't want to listen because they didn't understand it either. And man didn't understand it until God completed the revelation of the mystery. And Paul said, I wrote it down whereby when you read it, you can perceive my understanding in the mystery of Christ. Beloved, let all the earth stand in awe
of the greatness and the plan of God when things are troublesome around us and we fail to understand all of the things that are taking place. You see, stubbornness and arrogance caused Pharaoh to say, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" Well, that don't help anything, does it? That doesn't help anything. Material prosperity cannot deliver us. When God announced that he would stir up the Medes and the Persians, God said they would not be bribed, they'll not be bought off. Not enough power to do it. Military might cannot do so. Can't deliver one from the judgment of God. So, beloved, when we stand in the day of adversity, what do? When you don't understand, the Old Testament prophet said, you consider it's time to think. Pray for our nation. Why do you suppose Paul said to pray for those who are in positions of power that we might lead a quiet and tranquil life? You see, I don't know what political authorities are going to do. I don't know what decisions they're going to make. And bless your heart, I don't know what the future holds for you or me, but I know who does. I have to believe in him. And when the world was in turmoil and I don't understand, my responsibility is to read, to believe what God says, and in simple and humble obedience, do what it says. And God will take care of the rest. That's all I know. Do you know anything different to that? I don't know what else to do because that's all the Bible tells us to do. Trust in what he says. But, beloved, it's a good time to take a good look at you and a good look at me and see where we stand before God and help others to seek God, as was the case in Acts chapter 8 and Acts chapter 17. Now that's where I am on that. But I want to suggest this thought to you as well. Though you are a citizen in a national arena, you are also a citizen of God's kingdom. And that kingdom is one that was prophesied by Daniel in Daniel chapter 2 that would break in pieces and consume all others and stand forever. It's described by the Hebrew writer as a kingdom that cannot be shaken. That's what you've become a part of. And when you look at the world and all of its troubles, what do? You say, the Lord is in his holy temple, that all the earth keeps silence before him. I'm not going to worry my pretty little head to the extent that I can't sleep at night over national affairs. Because I've become a part of something greater than national affairs. How about you? And friend, if you're not a part of it tonight, you can be. Do you believe God? Do you believe what he says? Do you believe what he says enough to commit yourself to his trust? Obey. Repent of your sin. Confess your faith and be baptized into a kingdom that cannot be removed, one that cannot be shaken, one that's eternal in its nature. If you'll do that, you'll be a part of the kingdom of God. And you don't have to worry about things that are temporal. Maybe you've obeyed the gospel and you've not lived faithfully. Beloved, you need to give some concern to that. You'll be ultimately lost unless you do. Repent of it and ask God's forgiveness. We can help you by praying with you and for you to that end. Make it known. All together we stand and sing this wonderful song.